Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. In Washington, politicians play a numbers game. The 104th Congress busy changing the numbers on key environmental bills. How, why, and to what effect, we'll have the story. Also, Ken Goddard, author of Wildfire, a frightening look at one possibility.
What I've written about is an extremist environmental group who views the human beings as being more of a virus than a useful part of the environment. And their view is that the only way that the environment can recover, that Earth can recover, that the animals will be back and things be as they're supposed to be, is to have a cleansing fire.
The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson.
Well, we're guilty as charged. We did indeed grab S-39.
Mitch Rose is press secretary to Alaska Senator Ted Stevens. As Republicans prepare to take over leadership of both houses of Congress, one of Alaska's Republican senators, Ted Stevens, reserved the number 39. He will be using it to identify a piece of legislation he will be working on, Senate Bill number 39. The problem, says Lenny Combe, director of the Last Great Wilderness Project, S-39 is a bill he has been working on. They are not the same bill at all. The Last Great Wilderness Project has been pushing for federal action to prevent oil and gas drilling in the coastal plain and the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge of Alaska. Combs says there were 134 co-sponsors in the House and 30 in the Senate of a bill that would accomplish just this. Combs says it looked good.
I felt secure in the 103rd Congress that it certainly wouldn't be opened up for drilling. Not while the makeup of the Congress was as it was, and certainly not while the current administration is in office. I felt relatively secure that there would be no development. What did make me nervous was there didn't seem to be enough activity even on the side of the environmental organizations or the members of Congress to really get this thing moving, that is, to get final wilderness designation for the coastal plain. I felt that it was a great opportunity to do that, and we had a timetable which would have taken us up probably for another year and a half from now, and by then we would have hoped to have had it done.
But the great elections of 1994 kind of changed things. What's happened?
Well, what's happened since the elections of 94, The 104th Congress, that is the incoming Congress, of course everyone knows has a Republican majority, and that is not bad in itself, but what is bad is that all the committee chairs changed. So first of all, in the House of Representatives, the new chair of the Natural Resources Committee is Congressman Don Young of Alaska, and Congressman Young, for as long as I have been involved in this issue, has been the one that has introduced any legislation that would open it up for oil and gas development. And he's now the chair of the Natural Resources Committee. So that's a big problem for us. Another big problem that we have is that in the Senate, the same thing happened. The Energy and Natural Resources Committee is one of the committees in the Senate that would have jurisdiction over that issue, either development or wilderness, and that is now being chaired by Senator Frank Murkowski of Alaska. Senator Murkowski was also the one who was the author and primary sponsor of the development bills when they've been in Congress. So certainly that situation with the two committee chairs that we have to face are going to do everything they can, certainly to stop any wilderness legislation, and we would imagine will probably do what they can to open it up.
And we understand, in fact, that they've already done a great deal that you had not counted on.
Yeah, they've done some things. Certainly they've been busy. I understand from my friends and colleagues in Washington that the oil lobbyists are very busy on the Hill and gearing up for a big effort. But one of the thing that really bothered me, and I sort of expected it, but still it is a very scurrilous action. What happened was Senator Ted Stevens, the other senator from Alaska, the senior senator from Alaska, went in to reserve a number from the clerk of the Senate. We have had the same numbers on our bills for as long as I can remember. It's been H.R. 39 in the House and S. 39 in the Senate. And just before our champion, Senator Roth of Delaware, was going in to reserve the number, I understand it was 5 minutes before, Senator Stevens went in and reserved S. 39. So that creates a very big problem for us.
Presumably to use it for some other legislative piece some other time that may have absolutely nothing to do with the protection of the coastal plain and the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Right. In fact, he may have in mind using it for a development bill, and that creates a very big problem for us.
How so?
Well, we've worked really hard over the past 7 years on building up this network of people who care about this area across the country, and they have always been writing letters and talking about H.R. 39 and S. 39. And what bothers me is that these people will probably continue to write, and they may ask their congresspeople to support S. 39, for instance, which could very well be a development bill.
As we heard, Mitch Rose in Senator Stevens' office says, guilty as charged. Indeed, Senator Stevens did go in and did grab number 39.
For years, it's been used as kind of an anti-Alaska bill, lock up Anwar, make it hard for us to use our lands and our rights. But I think the environmentalists will be happy with the outcome, however, because we're reserving S-39 to introduce a reauthorization of the Magnuson Fishery Conservation Act, and basically that is the act that deals with federal oversight of fisheries off the coast of the United States, and the goal of our legislation is to reduce the enormous waste and bycatch that we're seeing in the fisheries. Just off the coast of Alaska, one fishery, we waste as much as 740 million pounds of groundfish, and Senator Stevens wants to put an end to that. So I think the environmentalists can still put out their letters, and maybe for once they'll get behind an effort that we're doing, and they can still extol the virtues of S-39. It won't be their bill to lock up Alaska and to take away jobs and domestic oil production, but it will be something that they can get behind, and that is the protection of our fishery species, and hopefully they'll support us on that.
Was there something important about getting number 39, or could the Magnuson Act reauthorization have been assigned a different number than 39? Was 39 critical? Was that part of the plan to get 39?
Well, as I said before, 39 has always been kind of used as a bill number that has been against the vast majority of Alaskans' interests. Here was a way to turn the tables and to show that, indeed, this is a bill that the vast amount of Alaskans support. And it's a bill that we think is very important. So, yes, I think we took that number because it's a number that's always been identified with Alaska here in the halls of Congress, and now it can be identified with taking some proactive steps to help maintain our thriving fishing industry rather than locking up our resources, which was the goal of many of the environmental groups that you've spoken with. We've also reserved S-49, which is obviously we're the 49th state in the Union. So we do this all the time, various numbers that have some meaning to Alaskans or to the senator. It's very common in all Senate offices to make those choices. There's always a big bidding war, of course, for S-1. Usually Senator Dole, in this case the majority leader, will have rights on that, as Senator Mitchell, I'm sure, had back in the beginning of the last Congress. So it's nothing new to the Capitol to try to tie numbers to bills, but the most important thing, obviously, is what the bills actually achieve. The number is secondary.
It may be secondary to those inside the hallowed halls of the Capitol, but to Lenny Combe, changing the number represents a dirty trick-style campaign.
We think that one of the reasons they did it was they did a similar thing on the Johnson-Wallop bill. They initially introduced it under, I can't remember the number, it was 741 or 714 or something like that. And then they gave that about a month, and then they pulled it and reintroduced it and gave it a whole new number, which was number S-1221. And knowing full well that we environmentalists don't have much money and all our material had been printed and everything had been sent out, and So now, at that point, we had to go back and redo everything, and now we're facing a similar situation.
Apparently, then, little difference between the Democratic 103rd and the Republican 104th. Lenny Combe, director of the Last Great Wilderness Project, one of many organizations active in seeking legislative protection of the coastal plain and the wildlife refuge on the North Slope of Alaska. Mitch Rose is press secretary to Alaska Senator Ted Stevens. Whatever happens in the 104th Congress regarding environmental legislation, it would seem the best strategy, regardless of your opinion of a bill, would be to focus on the issues and not how they are packaged. This is Bruce Robertson. The provincial Canadian utility Hydro-Québec has announced a major breakthrough in electric vehicle technology. Long known in the news for its controversial hydroelectric generating projects planned in the area of James Bay, Hydro-Québec says it has found a way to make electric cars really viable. German Harbeck is project manager for this research. He says it's a bit like reinventing the wheel.
The motor is the wheel is the motor.
And by way of a contrast to existing technologies, how is this different?
It depends on to what you are comparing. If you are comparing strictly with other motor wheel projects, we claim that we have a high torque, which means the motor could push very hard on the car without any reduction, a gear reduction box.
So what you have here is an electric drive for each wheel as opposed to a power station that drives all four at the same time.
That's right. There's a motor in each wheel, so it's continuously operating four-wheel drive.
And how is this more efficient than the technology that we otherwise have been working with up to now, most of those who build electric vehicles, where you have a powerhouse that drives all four at the same time?
One of the major points to improve efficiency is by removing the mechanical powertrain. There is no more mechanical powertrain because the motor is directly in the wheel. You have only two bearings in each wheel supporting the car. And all the losses in this mechanical system are simply not there because there's no such parts.
And technically speaking, how is it that you will assure that the wheels will be all turning at the same ratio, the same rate?
That's the function of the central processor unit, which is simply a computer which controls on a real-time basis each wheel on a very accurate way, and that is doing the job.
How far away from mass production would you say this new vehicle with the four wheels driving would be from being available in showrooms?
Presently, we are still developing the powertrain in the lab, I should say. But let's say that most likely in 5 years from now, it could be on the road.
It's curious, how is it that a provincial utility would get involved with a vehicle technology? I'm thinking, are you here, in essence, creating for yourselves a new market that people who would be driving electric vehicles would need to get charged up somewhere, and where better to go than Hydro-Québec?
Someone at Hydro-Québec, Pierre Couture, the one which gave the name to the powertrain, had that idea more than 12 years ago, you know. And the major point is that we are not developing a new car. We are developing a new powertrain, and this is an electrical powertrain. And as this was within our expertise in the electrical engineering, power engineering, and software, so this is why we concentrated on that and not on the development of a new car.
Would you have enough to supply everyone? It's probably safe to say that not every driver would be driving an electric vehicle. There will be other types of power that we will use, but those who choose the electric vehicle as their preferred choice for, other than gasoline or fossil fuels. If they were to choose the electric, would you have enough power to supply their needs?
This will be known in the planification for the forecast of the demand, because we will see that this technology is coming up. And as I mentioned, that we are in the few percent increase in the energy demand over a relatively long period of time. So normally the planification could take care of it.
If you felt that in your long-term planning that you would fall short of the necessary electricity to supply this new and growing market, would you foresee building new capacity?
Yes, because the Hydro-Quebec mandate is to fulfill the electric needs for the whole province of Quebec. But it will be the same, nevertheless, in that state. So, also, all public utilities, they must forecast the demand and try to fulfill it.
Would you see, perhaps, then, if you got a forecast picture that showed a new need, an increased need capacity, would you see the reopening the Great Whale Project, for example?
I don't know. I can't really answer on that. It will be within the planning, and normally we have many options with quite so many projects, and depending on the forecast for the energy demand increase, it will be within the portfolio project that we have in hand. So I don't know which one could be selected.
But it's a possibility?
It's a project which is known from everywhere. I don't know what would be the final decision about Hydro-Quebec.
Great Whale is the multi-billion-dollar project to build a series of dams on rivers flowing into the Hudson Bay. The project, recently postponed by Quebec Premier Jacques Parizeau, would have resulted in the flooding of vast tracts of land owned and used by native Cree and Inuit. Parizeau said there was no need for the electricity that would have been generated by this project. Great Whale, also known as James Bay, had been opposed by environmentalists worldwide. Harbeck said, should electric vehicle use increase demand, it is conceivable that Great Whale might get a green light. For now, he says, the vehicle is still in the prototype testing phase. The project is called M4, four motors, four wheels. This is Bruce Robertson. Cassette copies of The Environment Show are available by calling 1-800-747-7444. Ask for this week's program, number 259. That's 1-800-747-7444. The Environment Show, program number 259. It is only a book. It is only a book. It's fiction. You keep reminding yourself this as you read Ken Goddard's recent book, Wildfire. He calls it a novel. Director of Fish and Wildlife's Forensics Lab, Goddard has seen enough in his real life to write a dozen more like it. The storyline is nearly too terrible to tell.
What I've written about is an extremist environmental group who've used the human beings as being more of a virus than a useful part of the environment. And their view is that the only way that the environment can recover, that Earth can recover, that the animals will be back and things be as they're supposed to be, is to have a cleansing fire.
Even more frightening, says Goddard, the idea came from someone who holds this view. Of course, there is a tremendous difference between concept and action. At least, this is what you hope as you read. This is fiction, after all. Or is it?
The premise of the activist environmental group is out there. These are people that, at least there's a small number that I'm aware of, who hold this view that the only way to deal with the environmental issues is ultimately to eradicate what man has done to the Earth and start over. This is a real possibility because the technology is getting to the point where such things are possible. I dreamed up a piece of technology, small nuclear devices made with nuclear waste that would basically designed to use heat to melt go gold out of veins, and there you'd basically drill and inject a number of these devices, one of which would trigger the next one to keep the heat going and melt the gold out so it'd be accessible. And the premise I used was that this environmental group would manage to get their hands on these devices and set them in the forest X number of miles apart from each other so that one fire would trigger the next fire and go over several thousand miles. I don't think that technology is there at this point, but it's certainly a doable piece of technology, and that's one of the scary parts about it. As far as the agents goes, it's all perfectly real. We have covert teams. That's exactly how they work. The lab is real. I run it. I just hope we don't have to run across these types of characters in my career or lifetime.
And yet we have seen examples precariously close to those stories and episodes outlined in your book, Wildfire, that you just put a chill in most of us. For example, during the Gulf War, the oil fires that were set, we believe were set not in the heat of battle, but quite deliberately. Is that one of the examples that you see?
It's an exact example, that precise thing, which you can use something like an oil spill or the wells to either hold a group at bay or to hold a country as hostage. You hold the environment as hostage, really. You can not just threaten, you can threaten the oil, the air, the land, water, resources, wells, aquifers. There's an unending list of things that you can do against larger groups of people, and all within the existing technology, you know, biohazard, chemical hazard issues.
Why do you suppose we haven't seen more of this when we've seen many episodes on a consumer level of tampering with medications and all of the different things that have happened as a result as we've tried to protect ourselves from that? You've just mentioned we've got aquifers that supply thousands, if not millions, of people. We've got air sheds. We've got water tables. We've got fishing grounds. We've got just a long, long list of places where, with a minimum amount of work, a great deal of damage and great effect could be achieved. Why do you suppose these things have not been
tried? First of all, is that that's such a such a suicidally self-destructive act. One, you've got to presumably live in the environment you're destroying. Number two, you're not going to bring people onto your side if you're trying to be to convert people over to your beliefs. You're going to do exactly the opposite. Those that survive will be completely turned against you. So, I mean, it's the type of thing, from my viewpoint, that takes a almost a religious fundamentalist fever and that you've seen with some of the previous events out there. That intense belief in what you're doing, that you don't care about your own death or about the deaths of others or about the environment. Clearly, Saddam Hussein didn't seem overwhelmingly concerned about the environment when those wells were torched and the oil was dumped in the Gulf. It takes that type of personality to do for that kind of destruction, but those personalities are out there.
Ken Goddard, a forensics expert with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife's Forensics Lab, where he investigates the illegal killing of protected animals. With his other hat, he is a writer and author of the recent book Wildfire, an enthralling fictional account of what could happen with the right technology in the wrong hands. It is available from Forge Press. This is Bruce Robertson. That's our report on the Environment Show this week. Glad you joined us. Make a note, tune in again next week for more news on the environment. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. Our thanks this week to production assistant Linda Anderson. Next week, good news in North Carolina, Georgia Pacific, and the Nature Conservancy. We hope you'll join us. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. And this is Bruce Robertson.